This episode of The Y-Files is brought to you by PDS Debt.
Gather around. This happened. September 11th, 1997. 4 years before that date would mean something else entirely. A Thursday night in the desert. Art Bell sat in his home in Corrupt, Nevada, a double-wide trailer 60 miles west of Vegas, broadcasting coast-to-coast AM to millions of insomniacs across the country. If you're watching this channel, you already know who Art Bell was. He's one of our biggest inspirations. That night, Art opened his special Area 51 line, a dedicated number for government employees who wanted to share secrets. No screening, no caller ID, no questions about your identity. You called, and if you got through, you were live, talking to millions of people who would never know your name. Most Area 51 callers were measured, rehearsed. They prepared their statements about classified projects and underground facilities. The calls were fascinating, but controlled. This caller was different. He wasn't reading from notes. He was hyperventilating. He was crying, begging Art Bell to believe him before it was too late. And then, mid-sentence, the line went dead. But it wasn't just the phone call that died.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Oh, thank goodness you're here. Where's the first aid kit and an extra cash stash?
What's the cash for now?
I gotta pay this guy off to keep quiet.
What are you talking about? What happened?
One of the Beaver Brothers. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Wyatt. One of the Beaver Brothers bit a customer.
What do you mean a customer?
Well, he thought the guy's hand was a biscotti. Look, it was dry, knobbly, and honestly, the guy was asking for it. It's not my fault if he doesn't moisturize.
Why was some guy trying to touch Wyatt?
Oh, that's how we do things here at the Beaver Cafe.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. You bring a date, order a drink, and spend an hour petting a beaver together.
Do you even hear yourself? Do you know how that sounds?
That sounds adorable. It's about connection. It's about touch. It's about beaver enrichment. You know, not a lot of people have experience touching a nice beaver.
You charge people to touch wet beavers.
Oh, there's something healing about it. A warm latte in one hand, a nice wet beaver in the other. Now that's what I call wellness.
Look, what is this really about?
I'm up to debt in my beautiful caramel latte scented deals. And not only do I have to pay that guy off, I have to pay off my credit card debt. But before that, I need to pay whatever I charged at 2 a.m. when I thought I was buying a hot tub. I gotta stop taking Ambien and going on Amazon.
Okay. Maybe it's time you try PDS Debt.
Did you just slap a QR code on my dignity and call it today's sponsor?
What gave you that idea? You say you want a fresh start, but your debt is still there, and it's getting worse every month. But there is a way out. PDS Debt has helped hundreds of thousands escape debt with personalized plans tailored to your situation. And there's no minimum credit score required. PDS Debt is here to help you save more, pay off debt faster, and start putting money back in your pocket. They're A-plus rated by the BBB and have thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot. Proof that PDS Debt is a trusted solution for people who need real help. We've all been there. Debt is overwhelming. The interest piles up and you feel stuck. Waiting only adds more interest and fees. Whether it's credit cards, personal loans, medical bills, or collections, PDS Debt understands your situation and can offer alternative solutions. Don't wait another month. Change your story in 30 seconds. Get your free personalized assessment and the best option for you at PDSDebt.com/files.
PDSDEBT.com/files.
That's right.
Oh, that's one less flaming disaster.
You mean your debt?
No, the IRS sought it. Apparently, beaver fondling isn't a valid business discussion. Go figure. Listen, I gotta go. Gertie's back. I sent her for milk, but they ran out, so she made her own. Honey, you know it's not pasteurized.
Most callers on Coast to Coast AM were calm. They'd rehearse their stories, organize their thoughts, prepared to sound credible on national radio. They wanted to be taken seriously. This caller was hyperventilating. His voice cracked and broke as he tried to get words out between gasps for air. He was a former employee of the Area 51, and he was on the run.
Were you an employee or are you now?
A former employee.
Former employee.
I was let go on a medical discharge about a week ago, and I've kind of been running across the country. I don't know where to start.
He said he didn't have much time. They would triangulate his position soon, whoever they were. He wasn't talking to the audience. He was talking to Art Bell like a lifeline, like Art was the only person in the world who might believe him before it was too late. Then he dropped a bombshell.
Okay, well, what we're thinking of as aliens, Art, they're extra-dimensional beings that an earlier precursor of the space program made contact with. They are not what they claim to be.
The aliens, he said, had been lying about everything. The government wasn't in control of the situation. The entities weren't from Mars or some distant solar system. They were extra-dimensional. They came from a different plane of reality, and they had infiltrated the military establishment at the highest levels. The caller's fear was contagious. You can hear it through the phone line, mixing with static. This wasn't entertainment. This was a man who believed he was about to die. He warned Art about upcoming disasters. The government knew what was coming. They were preparing to move people out of major cities, but not to save them. They wanted the major population centers wiped out. Art tried to calm him down, tried to get him to slow down and explain, but the caller was past point of reason. He'd seen something, and whatever it was had broken him. And he was mid-sentence when the line went dead. The caller was cut off mid-word. One moment he was speaking, then nothing. Silence. It wasn't just the phone call that died. Art Bell's entire show went offline. Coast to Coast AM broadcast via satellite uplink. The signal traveled from Art's trailer in Pahrump to a transponder on GE-1, a communication satellite built by GE Americom, parked in geostationary orbit 22,300 miles above the equator. From there, it bounced back down to Earth stations operated by the network, which fed the signal to over 500 affiliate stations nationwide. The system was solid, professional, built with redundancies. It almost never failed. Art had been on the air for years without a major technical dropout. The system was built to keep working through storms, through equipment failures, through almost everything. At the exact moment the caller was about to reveal something, the satellite link cut out. Across America, millions of radios went silent. The signal just vanished. Art scrambled in his studio, checking monitors, looking for any explanation. The carrier signal was gone. He switched to backup phone lines and called the network. They were panicking too. The Earth station had lost its lock on the satellite. The technical crew couldn't explain it. A dropout that sudden and complete meant either a massive energy surge or a targeted jamming signal. Something had reached up into space and killed the connection. Art eventually got back on the air, and he was shaken. The timing was too perfect, too precise. The caller had been seconds away from saying something specific, and at that exact moment, someone or something pulled the plug. Not a guy in a basement with a radio jammer, and not a freak storm. You don't accidentally knock out a geostationary satellite transponder. That takes real hardware. That takes someone who knows the uplink frequency, the beam footprint, and has the power to overwhelm it. Someone didn't want the caller to finish that sentence. The frantic caller incident became one of the most chilling moments in radio history, and it spread the way things spread in 1997, slowly, through word of mouth, tape trading, and early internet message boards. There was no YouTube, no Reddit, no social media. People dubbed copies of the broadcast onto cassette tapes and mailed them to friends. They posted about it on Usenet groups and proto-forums dedicated to Coast to Coast AM. The audio circulated through a network of true believers who treated it like contraband, forbidden information passed hand to hand. Art Bell's audience was loyal and obsessive. They recorded every broadcast. They cataloged them. Within weeks, the frantic caller tape was the most requested piece of audio in Coast to Coast history. People listen to it hundreds of times, dissecting every word, every breath, every moment of silence before the signal died. A few weeks after the incident, a man called Coast to Coast AM. He said he was the original caller. He said it was all a hoax. He was an actor who had gotten carried away with a performance, and he wanted to set the record straight. The audience didn't buy it. The second caller sounded different. The voice was similar, but not the same. The rhythm was wrong. The original caller had been hyperventilating and sobbing and speaking in fragments because he couldn't catch his breath. The second caller was calm and smooth. He laughed at the right moments. He sounded like he was reading from a script. Longtime listeners, the ones who had played the original tape over and over, noticed it immediately. His pitch was slightly off. The vocal tics didn't match. The raw animal terror of the first call was gone. Arpil himself seemed unconvinced. He let the second caller talk, but he didn't push back hard, and he didn't endorse the explanation. He moved on. The audience took that as a signal. It felt like damage control. The theories multiplied. Maybe the government found the original caller and forced him to recant, or found someone close enough to pass. Maybe the original caller was never found at all. Maybe he was triangulated just like he feared. Maybe the second caller was a plant, sent by military intelligence to close the loop and kill the story before it spread further than tape-trading networks could carry it. But the satellite failure is the part that can't be explained away. You can fake a voice. You can fake a script. You can hire an actor to call a radio show and pretend to be terrified. But you can't fake a satellite dying 22,000 miles above the Earth. You can't fake an Earth station losing its lock at the exact moment of a reveal. That takes real power. That takes infrastructure. That takes someone who was listening and had the ability to reach into space and end the conversation. The incident changed the landscape of paranormal broadcasting. It proved that late-night radio could produce moments that felt genuinely dangerous. Not scripted, not safe, not entertainment. Every paranormal show that came after Coast to Coast AM, every conspiracy podcast, every late-night live stream chasing the strange and unexplained, exists in the shadow of Art Bell's studio in Pahrump. And the frantic caller is the moment that sealed it. The moment the audience believed, truly believed, that someone powerful was listening to the same broadcast they were. Art Bell kept going. He hosted Coast to Coast for another 6 years before his first retirement in 2003. He came back. He always came back. He died in 2018 in that same trailer in Pahrump, surrounded by his equipment, his transmitter still standing nearby. The show continues without him. The caller warned about extra-dimensional beings inside the government. He warned about planned disasters and population reduction. In 1997, it sounded like paranoid fantasy. Today, those warnings had echoed through decades of conspiracy theory, growing louder as trust in institutions has fallen apart. Maybe he was crazy. Maybe he was an actor who got lucky with his timing. Maybe the satellite failure really was a coincidence, a one-in-a-billion glitch that happened at exactly the wrong moment. Or maybe someone was listening, someone who didn't like what they heard, someone who reached into the sky and pulled the plug before the caller could say too much. The audio is still out there. You can listen to all of it right now. The fear in that man's voice is real, or it's the greatest performance in radio history. And somewhere 22,000 miles above the Earth, a satellite that failed could fail once again. So the next time your phone call drops, the next time your internet cuts out for no reason, don't assume it's a glitch. Assume someone is listening. Gather round. This happened. The Mojave Desert, California, 1997, 15 miles from the nearest paved road. Down a rutted dirt track most vehicles couldn't handle, there stood a phone booth. A standard Pacific Bell booth. Glass walls, metal shelf, dangling phone book, working dial tone. It had been there for decades. No one remembers exactly why. The mine it served closed years ago. The workers were long gone. But Pacific Bell kept paying the electricity. The line stayed active. The booth just sat there in the emptiness, waiting. Then a man named Godfrey Doc Daniels found the number. He read about it in a punk zine. Some guy in Los Angeles had spotted a tiny telephone icon on the map and driven out to find it. Something about that stuck with Daniels. A phone booth in the middle of nowhere. A working number that no one ever called. He started calling every day. He taped each call, stated the date and time, let the phone ring, and hung up. He stuck a post-it note on his bathroom mirror. Did you remember to call the Mojave Desert today? He made every visitor to his house call the number 2. Half an hour of tape. Nothing but ringing and the sound of his friends leaving messages for nobody. Then, less than a month in, June 20th, he got a busy signal. Someone was using the phone. He hit redial over and over until the line started ringing again. A woman answered. Her name was Lorene. She lived out near the old mine. She didn't have a phone of her own, so she walked to the booth. Daniels built a website about it. He posted the number, 760-733-9969, and a simple challenge. Call it. See if anyone answers. The internet fell in love. People started calling from around the world. London, Tokyo, Sao Paulo. The phone rang constantly in the empty desert, day and night. Then, people started making the trip. They wanted to be on the other end. They wanted to answer. And what they found out there changed them forever. People started calling the Mojave phone booth from around the world. The phone rang constantly in the empty desert day and night, and eventually people started making the trip to answer it. They drove for hours on paved highway, then turned onto 15 miles of unpaved dirt road that rattled their cars and covered everything in dirt. They arrived at a phone booth standing alone in a landscape so empty it could have been on another planet. The glass was shot out. The phone book was gone. Graffiti covered every surface. Names, dates, messages from people who'd made the journey. And they waited. When the phone rang, the sound hit hard. In the total silence of the desert, no traffic, no voices, no hum of any kind, a ringing phone was almost violent, and you couldn't ignore it.
That's weird. Mojave Desert. This is it. Fine, thanks.
People picked up and found themselves talking to strangers from halfway around the world.
So there's actually a modern push-button phone there?
Yes, there is.
And nobody's ripped it out or destroyed it?
No, and Art, it rings 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from around the world. I talk to Switzerland, I talk to Australia, Africa, of course I talk to Kansas, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
The conversations were strange and personal. Something about the isolation made people open up. They told secrets. They confessed things they'd never said out loud. They talked to the booth like it was a priest, anonymous and free of judgment. The New York Times wrote about it in May 1998. That blew the doors off. Documentary crews showed up. Musicians wrote songs about it. The booth got its own fan sites, its own mythology. People camped next to it for days, waiting for the next call, talking to whoever happened to dial the number. This was 1997, 1998, 1999, the early internet, when the web still felt like a place where weird things could happen, where a phone booth in the desert could become the most important place in the world just because enough people decided it was. But there was something else about the phone calls. They weren't always friendly. Campers at the booth started reporting strange things. Not every call was a curious stranger or a fellow fan. Some calls were just static, a low electrical hum that sounded like the desert wind had gotten into the wires. Some were garbled voices, words that didn't quite form into anything you could understand. Sounds that might have been human, or might not have been. One camper answered a call at 3 in the morning. The desert was pitch black. No moon, no artificial light for miles in any direction. Just stars and silence. He picked up the receiver. A voice whispered, "I see you." He looked around. Nothing. Darkness in every direction. No cars, no flashlights, no movement. He was alone. He hung up. The phone rang again. Same voice, same whisper. "I see you." He didn't answer the third time. He got in his car and drove 15 miles of dirt road in the dark. The whole way out, he couldn't shake the feeling that something was watching him from the hills. Other visitors reported the same kind of thing. Calls that felt off. Voices that didn't sound quite human. The feeling of being watched in a place where no one should have been watching. Some saw lights in the sky above the booth. Not planes or satellites. Something else. Others felt vibrations in the ground when the phone rang. Like the booth was connected to something underneath the desert. The booth pulled in true believers who thought it was a portal. A beacon. An antenna drawing attention from things that weren't human. It pulled in skeptics who came to prove the stories wrong and left feeling uneasy. And it pulled in people who just wanted to answer a phone in the middle of nowhere to prove that connection was still possible even in the most isolated place on Earth. And for 3 years, the Mojave phone booth rang. On May 17th, 2000, Pacific Bell sent a crew into the desert. They tore down the booth, ripped up the concrete pad, and disconnected the line. Per company policy, the phone number was retired. A PacBell spokesman later confirmed what fans had feared. They hadn't just removed the booth, they destroyed it. The official reason was environmental damage. Too many visitors driving off-road tearing up the desert, leaving trash in what had become the Mojave National Preserve. But there was more to it. The preserve superintendent had confronted PacBell about long-forgotten easement fees for the land the booth sat on. Fees that had gone unpaid for years, maybe decades. Pacific Bell didn't fight it, they just pulled the plug. The number, 760-733-9969, went dead. Someone placed a headstone at the site, an actual grave marker, like a memorial for a dead friend. The National Park Service removed that too. But people still visit. They drive the 15 miles of dirt road, park in the sand, and stand in the empty spot where the booth used to be. Nothing there now. Just scrub brush and the faint outline where concrete once was, and the desert is already taking it back. Visitors hear a phantom ring, a faint electronic sound rising from the desert floor, coming from nowhere, drifting across the emptiness. The people who hear it swear it's real. It sounds like the booth is still there, buried under the sand, still connected to something, still waiting for someone to answer. In 2013, a phone freak named Lucky225 acquired the old number through a voiceover IP provider. He set it up so callers could reach a conference line, strangers talking to strangers again, just like the old days. The booth was gone, but the number lived. Doc Daniels spent 10 years writing a book about the whole thing. Adventures with the Mojave Phone Booth came out in 2018, funded by a Kickstarter campaign. NPR's Snap Judgment did a segment on it. The podcast 99% Invisible devoted an episode to it. The novelist J.G. Ballard called the booth a kind of talismanic object, something that shouldn't have mattered, but did, for reasons nobody could fully explain. Thousands of people drove hours into the desert just to talk to strangers. They told secrets to a phone booth in the middle of nowhere because it felt safer than telling anyone they actually knew. The booth was a piece of forgotten equipment, a leftover from 1948 that nobody bothered to disconnect, a policy station for a dead mind. The desert is quiet now. The concrete is gone. The confessional is closed. But somewhere under the sand, something is still waiting for a signal. Gather round. This happened. October 1996. The Cascade Mountains in Washington State. Dr. Jonathan Reed was hiking with his golden retriever, Susie, enjoying a crisp autumn afternoon in the woods. Reed was a psychologist with a private practice, an educated man, not the type to invent stories about aliens. The woods were quiet. Too quiet. Then Susie barked and ran into the brush ahead of him. Reed heard a commotion, a low humming sound, then a yelp, the sound of an animal in pain. He grabbed a tree branch and ran toward the noise. He entered a clearing and stopped. A black triangular craft hovered silently above the ground, and beneath it stood a creature, small and gray, and it was holding what was left of his dog. The creature moved with impossible speed. It had Susie by the jaw, and in one motion, faster than Reed's eye could track, it crushed her skull. Dog didn't just die, she turned to powder. Bone and tissue reduced to dust in seconds. Reed didn't think. He swung the tree branch as hard as he could. Solid impact. The creature collapsed and lay still on the forest floor. The humming stopped. The woods went silent. It was heavy and oppressive, but the quiet that follows violence. Reed stood over the body, breathing hard, trying to understand what he was looking at. It wasn't human. The creature was about 4 feet tall, with grayish skin and large, dark, almond-shaped eyes. The body looked biological, but also synthetic, like living tissue stretched over machinery, a suit made of flesh, or flesh made to look like a suit. Reed threw up. He just killed an intelligent being, an extraterrestrial, a being that traveled across space or dimensions to end up dead in a forest clearing in Washington State, killed by a man with a tree branch. Then he realized he needed proof. He couldn't leave the body there. It would disappear, or someone would find it, or he'd come back tomorrow and convince himself that it never happened. He had to take it with him. Reed wrapped the creature in a foil emergency blanket from his hiking pack. It was heavier than it looked, and it smelled strange. It had a chemical odor like ozone mixed with sulfur. He carried it to his car, loaded it in the back, and drove home. He couldn't call the police. He couldn't call a hospital. He couldn't tell anyone without sounding insane. So he did the only thing that made sense. He put the alien in his chest freezer, shoved it behind the frozen vegetables, and closed the lid. Reed documented everything. He photographed the creature from every angle. He recorded video footage. That footage became some of the most analyzed alien evidence in history. In the footage, the creature's eyes are open, they're moist, they reflect light, and they blink. It wasn't dead, it was healing. Reed heard it screaming from inside the freezer, but the screaming was telepathic, a sound that bypassed his ears and pierced directly into his mind. It woke him at night. It followed him during the day, a high-pitched, agonizing shriek that sounded like a dolphin in pain. He also found an object at the crash site, a black bracelet that he called the Link. When he wore it, he could sense the creature's thoughts. He could feel its rage, its fear, its desperate attempts to reach others of its kind. The bracelet connected him to the entity in ways he didn't understand and couldn't control. Within weeks, men showed up at Reed's house. They weren't wearing suits like the classic men in black. They wore tactical gear, military equipment. They carried weapons, the kind of hardware you don't see outside of a combat zone. They raided his home. They killed people who had seen the evidence. They burned his records, his photographs, his backup files. Reed went on the run. He said the government erased his identity, deleted his university records, his professional licenses, his birth certificate. He became a ghost, a man with no official existence, hiding from people who wanted him dead or silent.
This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell, and tonight you're going to get what you've been waiting for. An alien encounter that Dr. Jonathan Reed had about 2 years ago, and you're going to hear the entire story in a moment.
He appeared on Coast to Coast AM to tell his story. He sounded exhausted. He sounded broken, like a man who lost everything.
This is all happening in seconds.
I understand.
At that point, I ran forward, and I don't know where the logic came from. I don't know. There was no forethought. I literally struck with this bat, hitting the creature.
He played the audio of the creature screaming. Listeners heard that high-pitched trill cutting through the static, the sound of the being from another world crying out from inside a freezer. The Jonathan Reed story is polarizing. Skeptics say the alien was a rubber doll, the video was a puppet, and Reed was a con man trying to sell a book. They point out that his credentials can't be verified. They note that no one has ever found the crash site or found more evidence. But the details are haunting. The violence of the encounter, the way Susie was destroyed in seconds, reduced to powder by an entity that moved faster than human reflexes could follow. The specific smell of the creature, that ozone and sulfur chemical signature, the telepathic screaming that Reed described with the desperation of a man who couldn't make it stop. And the video. If the footage is fake, it's a masterpiece. The creature breathes. Its chest rises and falls in irregular rhythm. Its eyes are moist, catching the light the way living tissue catches light. When it blinks, the movement is uneven. Not the synchronized motion of a mechanical puppet, but the imperfect organic movement of real eyelids. In 1996, that kind of practical effects work would have required a professional studio, Jonathan Reed was a psychologist, not a special effects artist. He had no background in filmmaking, no access to Hollywood quality materials, no clear reason to destroy his own life or a hoax. Because his life was destroyed, Reed spent years in hiding. He lost his career, his home, his identity. He became a paranoid voice on late night radio, playing recordings that most people dismissed as fantasy. Hoaxers usually profit from their lives. Reed never got rich, never got famous. He got erased. The freezer is what makes this story different from every other alien encounter. It grounds the cosmic horror in everyday life. We all have freezers full of ice cream, frozen vegetables, leftovers we'll never eat. Jonathan Reed kept a healing extraterrestrial in his, wedged between the frozen peas and the ice cube trays. He slept in the next room while a being from another world repaired itself in the cold and the dark. He heard it screaming into his mind, and every morning he had to walk past that freezer to make his coffee. That's the horror of the Jonathan Reed story, the aftermath, the realization that you've brought something home that you can't explain, that you can't control, and can't let anyone see. The barrier between normal life and cosmic nightmare is exactly as thick as a freezer door. So next time you go hiking and your dog runs into the brush, think twice before you follow. Things in the woods don't want to be found. And remember, if you break them, you have to keep them. Thank you so much for hanging out today. My name is AJ. This is The Y-Files, and that was a campfire story. No debunking, no analysis, just a creepy story to scare you and the kids. And that one is true and unsolved. Now, if you had fun, I'd appreciate it if you can like, subscribe, comment, and share. That stuff really helps. And like most topics we cover here, today's was recommended by you. So if there's a story you'd like to see, go to yfiles.com/tips or send us an email. We'd love to cover that story. And if you'd like to hear any of these campfire stories expanded into a full episode, there's a few I'd like to do, then definitely let me know. Remember, The Y-Files is also a podcast. You can take us on the road. I post deep dives into the stories we cover on the channel. I also post episodes that wouldn't be allowed on the channel. The podcast is called The Y-Files, Operation Podcast, and it's available everywhere. And if you're listening on an audio platform, do me a favor, hit the thumbs up or the like or the follow or whatever those buttons are. Those really do help. Now, if you need more Y-Files in your life, check out our Discord. We're about to hit 100,000 members over there. It's a lot of fun. It's a really supportive community. There's someone on there 24/7, and it's free to join. Speaking of 24/7, check out our 24/7. I'm plowing through the plugs. Speaking of 24/7, make sure you check out our 24/7 stream in the Y-Files backstage. Over there, we run episodes back-to-back with some fun content in between, and the live chat is super, super fun. Special thanks to our patrons who make this channel possible and make every episode of The Y-Files happen. Every episode is dedicated to our Patreon members. I could not do this without you. If you'd like to support the channel, keep us going, consider becoming a member on Patreon. For as little as $3 a month, get access to perks like videos early with no commercials, exclusive merch, and 2 private live streams every week just for you to hear the whistle in my teeth. It's because I'm going too fast. The private live streams are a lot of fun for members only. My webcam is on. Everyone on the team has their camera on. You can talk to all of us. Turn your camera on, jump up on stage, ask a question. I think it's the best perk there is. Another great way to support the channel, grab something from the Y-Files store. That is shop@thewyfiles.com. You'll find it. But if you're going to buy merch, become a member on YouTube. YouTube members get 10% off everything in the Y-Files store forever. So if you're going to spend $40 on t-shirts and Fistable mugs, become a member on YouTube for $3. Pays for itself. And that money goes to the team, not to me. Those are the plugs. I got through them as fast as I could. And that's going to do it. Till next time, be safe, be kind, and know that you are appreciated.
In Area 51, a secret code inside the Bible said I was. I love my UFOs and paranormal fun, as well as music, so I'm singing like I should. But then another conspiracy theory becomes the truth, my friends, and it never ends. No, it never ends. The crap got and got stuck inside Mel's home with MK Ultra. I've been only too aware. Did Stanley Kubrick fake the moon landing?
set, or were the shadow people there?
The Roswell aliens just fought the smiling man,
I'm told, and his name was Cold.
And I can't believe I'm dancing with the fishes. Heckle fish on Thursday nights with AJ too, and
the solar storm still come to Agatha, the secret city underground. Mysterious number stations, planet Serpo 2, Project Stargate, and what the Dark Watchers found.
We're in a simulation, don't you worry though.
The Black Knight satellite, it told me so. I can't believe I'm dancing with